Okay. So, good morning, everybody. Unfortunately, I don't speak good French, medium French even, okay? So I will do my presentation, my talk in English, and I excuse myself for that, okay? And so Bernard presented you a lot of very, very beautiful calculations and a lot of derivations on measurements or on concepts related to fluctuations and responses. And actually what I'm going to show you today is that related to these correlations and responses, there are some beautiful measurements we can do in the lab playing with single molecules as model systems. And it turns out that although all these concepts that Bernard was presenting have been introduced in the context of physics and even chemistry, biology offers an excellent playground to test these theories and actually to get insight about possible hidden theories. Okay? So what I want to show you is that single molecules give us an observational window which is quite novel and quite remarkable with respect to standard physicochemical systems. Okay? So if I want to introduce the sort of, if I want to introduce single molecules and the interest of measuring energy information and testing the second law, the best thing I can do probably now is to start by introducing this book that was published in 1944 by Erwin Schrödinger, which was about life. And this book is probably one of the most essential books everyone who wants to do biophysics should read, because it puts in very clear terms what are the motivations any physicist, chemist would have in trying to understand living beings, trying to understand what are the hidden laws behind the behavior of living beings. And now the book is beautiful, it has many chapters. It starts with an introduction in which he just poses Erwin Schrödinger this question. I mean, is it somehow straightforward it's just straightforward to try to understand living organisms by using physicochemical laws. And it turns out that we know that living beings are made out of molecules, and molecules are governed by the laws of physics, and if you want, of chemistry. But of course, if you ask what is the main difference between a living being and an inanimate system, well, you start thinking about it, and there start being big questions and big doubts. And actually, after this work was published, which actually was the seed for many discoveries in the past century, among them the structure of nucleic acids by Watson and Crick, okay? If you look at what is the situation after 70 years later, and you ask where do we stand with respect to this initial quest by Erwin Schrödinger, I just took a book published like four years ago, with the same title as Erwin Schrödinger, which is What is Life? This book has been written by a chemist who is a chemist in Israel, Adi Pros, who tried to understand biology or living matter, not from the perspective of physics like Erwin Schrödinger might do, but from the chemistry side. At the end, what Adi Pros says is a beautiful book. He says something very interesting. He says that it's evident that living matter and inanimate matter are totally different, because there is a specific name for that difference which has been put forward by biologists, which is called this word teleonomy. So all living things, all living beings, behave as they have an agenda. So living things are here to do something. They have some specific businesses, okay? So some of them may build nests like birds, others may collect food, protect the young, and of course reproducing. Okay? Now, in the long-living world, there is no teleonomy at all. I mean, this teleonomy thing doesn't exist. It's not that there is any purpose in things doing what they do. So if you throw a ball into the air and you want to know where it will land, you just need to apply the Newton's law of gravity, and you will determine by following the trajectory where it will fall. But of course, there is no purpose in the ball. Okay? So it just follows Newton's law. Okay? And this is an essential difference because it is an essential difference because actually we don't know where the border between the inanimate and the animate lies. I mean, it's of course we know that nothing is violated and nothing like that happens, but we have a clear confusion about where is the border that goes from one step to the other. It's like the egg and chicken egg paradox. Okay, you don't know where to start, where is the origin, and where it starts everything. Now, the main point that I want to raise here, or the goal of my talk, is that to try to convey the message that rather than use biophysics is a very general term, that is the combination of physics tools and biological systems to try to get knowledge about how biology works. And actually, that has been the tradition. Biophysics is born by an effort of physicists or by an intention of physicists to provide tools to biologists. However, I think, and that's my perspective, that the other way around might be even more useful. So instead of you doing physics to apply the method from physics to biology, use the systems of biology to provide, that provides you to do physics. And who knows, maybe to search for new physics. Okay? So the question that we ask is whether there are some hidden, maybe physical principles in biology. So this is an analogy to what former Fitzgerald Kennedy said, that instead of asking what physics can do for biology, ask the other way around. Take the other question, what biology can do for physics. Okay? So try to get knowledge from biological systems from the perspective of physics, and use them for that goal. And what I'm going to show you is now is a very simple, very brief introduction about what are the single molecule experiments that, in my view, allow to do this, use biology to try to understand physics. And therefore, I'm going to show you how we are able to manipulate tiny small molecules, individual molecules, by using physical devices. And one of the instruments that we have been using in my lab is optical tweezers. Optical tweezers, you use the light that comes from lasers, you focus the light into a fluidic chamber, and therefore, by focusing light into the fluidic chamber, you can trap small particles, small micron-sized beads or particles, to exert very tiny forces on the order of piconewton. Okay? These very tiny forces are the relevant ones to pull and to probe the mechanical or to probe, let's say, the mechanical response of single molecules. Now, in this sort of optical tweezers technique, you use the light to trap this small micron-sized bead, and then you connect the micron-sized bead to another bead that is usually immobilized on the tip of a pipette, and in the molecule in the between can be manipulated, can be stretched, can be probed, okay, by just moving the optical trap, the position of the optical trap relative to the pipette. So actually, the optical trap acts like a spring that captures the bead in harmonic potential, and what you are doing is that you can stretch the molecule just by moving this potential, this harmonic potential, and therefore you can exert a force that you can measure on the molecule. Okay? So here you see just an illustration. This is not a single molecule. These are actually two molecules, but these two molecules are bonded by, for example, antigen-antibody interaction. So you can use that to probe not only intramolecular interactions by pulling a single molecule, but by probing intermolecular interactions by, for example, breaking molecular bonds. Okay? So the first example that shows you the power of this single molecule methodology is to pull, for example, a DNA molecule. Okay? So pulling a DNA, what does it mean? Pull a DNA means the following. take a single DNA molecule and pulling from its ends, while you record, you measure the force extension curve until it gets fully straightened. This is something that you might, 20 years ago, think it's not possible. Actually, it was not possible. But because of the development of these techniques, became possible and now is standard in many labs throughout the world. So we can actually do this. We can take a molecule, in this case a DNA, and pull it from its ends. This experiment that now is quite a standard is just illustrated here. This is a video image of the fluidic chamber. So here, everything you see in blue is water, basically. There are two beads. One bead, which is in this sort of cross. Here, there is the optical trap. Okay, and here, there is another bead in the pipette. And in the midwin, there is a molecule, a DNA molecule, which you don't see because it is illuminated with blue light, and you don't have enough short wavelength to see a DNA molecule, which, by the way, is a long linear object, this DNA molecule. Is like 8 microns contour length. But even if it is 8 microns contour length, you cannot see because the diameter is 2 nanometers. So with blue light, which is, I don't know, 500 nanometers, you cannot see that. Okay? And now this is an illustration of the experimental setup, let's say. This is the molecule that we express in the lab. We label the ends of the molecule to make the attachments to the beads. And in this case, we label with a biotin, and we label with an antigen at the other side. We also coat the beads with a molecular species that binds specifically to the biotin in this site. In this case, it's a streptavidin. And here we coat the bead with an antibody that binds to the antigen. So the antibody here is called anti-digoxygenin because digoxygen is an antigen. Okay? So here these bonds are sufficiently strong for us to be able to move the optical trap relative to the pipette and exert forces up to 100 piconewtons. Now you see this is a schematic representation of an optical trap. You will see a few times in this presentation. So, so to generate an optical trap, you need to focus the light. So in this slide, the light is coming transverse, perpendicular to the wall. And therefore, in this representation, what you see here is that the light comes from the left, is focused here, and of course, diverges again. So this is a quite typical representation of an optical trap. So this is possible. This is actually possible. And with this video, I just tried to show you that actually we can pull the DNA molecule. So what we need to do is first to so you see here it is water. This is an image CCD camera of the inside of the fluidic chamber. Here you have the pipette, a glass pipette, okay, which is which has a hole at the end. So by air suction, it's capable of trapping immobilized beads. And here you see this tiny spot here, which is very gently illuminated. This is the optical trap, which we put a filter, because otherwise it's too strong in light. So what you will see now in this experiment is that we use the optical trap. We move the fluidic chamber with some motors. We position it, the optical trap, close to the supplier tubes where the beads are coming in. We trap one bead, and we immobilize in the pipette. And that bead will be used to anchor one end of the DNA molecule. And the other bead will be subsequently after trapped in the optical trap, and the bead moved close to the pipette. That's more or less the scheme of the experiment. So let's go to search for the first bead coming from the supplier tube at the bottom of the fluidic chamber. We move with motors the fluidic chambers. The trap always is here in this tiny light spot. And then there are beads coming out. This has been a bit accelerated because the process is really slower in real time. Now we move the fluidic chamber and position the bead close to the pipette. And now by touching and by air suction with a syringe, we mobilize the bead in the pipette. This bead has, in this case, a streptavidin. It's coated with a streptavidin. And now we look for the other bead that has been previously incubated with DNA molecules. So these beads are bigger to discriminate from the other ones. And there are DNA molecules protruding from the surface. Okay, you don't know how many, but you mix concentrations in average to have one per bead. And now what we know is that the DNA is somewhere here. And what we need to now fish the end of the DNA, which is attached to this bead, okay, by moving this bead close to this other one. Now, in normal conditions, DNA forms a random coil. So because it forms a random coil, it's like a it's like condensed close to the bead surface. So if I want, even if it is 8 microns long, this 10 microns, I need to approach this bead to grab the end of the random coil because it's forming a globular structure rather than something extended. And you saw that now I got it and I have the DNA molecule. So now once you got the tether between the two beads, you can start measuring the mechanical response of the DNA molecule. How do you do that? Then what you do is you, this is just to show you that we have the tether, but at some point it will stop. And then this optical trap will be moved up and down, and the force measured in some position-sensitive detectors that are far away from the beams. And therefore, by measuring the deflection of these beams that reach the photodetectors, we can know the force. So we can convert deflection of light into force. And at the end, what you get is a very beautiful measurement, is what is called the force extension curve. This is a response quantity because it's the deformation of the DNA molecule upon the action of a mechanical force. So the force goes from 0 to 80 piconewtons, and the molecular extension goes from here up to 8 micron approximately. And you see this force growing up. And at some point, at 65 piconewtons, there occurs like a phase transition, because at constant force, which would be like a constant pressure, there is a change in the molecular extension, which would be like a change in the volume. And this plateau is the change between two, let's say, coexistent phases. And this has been hotly debated what it is about. This transition at 65 piconewtons was not known like 20 years ago. It was discovered precisely with these experiments. It has corroborated afterwards with AFM, even with magnetic tweezers. But the idea is that you can, well, this is a conformational transition that is wholly debated and is assumed to correspond to the unwinding of the double helix that goes from a double staircase to a ladder. So when you pull straight so much the DNA, you break the helicoidal symmetry, which contains some sort of circular symmetry, and you go to a ladder, which is something which is coupled with a pulling direction. Okay? So you break the symmetry, if you want. You break the helicoidal symmetry of the DNA molecule. That's the whole story. That's not the whole story, but it's part of it, let's say, in a big percentage. So that's one experiment which is classical. And actually, this experiment, you see the curve pulling is increasing, the force is going in the direction. But when you relax the force, you see sometimes the small stresses. This is because there are defects in the DNA, and some parts detach, and you have some sort of irreversibility due to this part of the DNA that is damaged somehow. But the most interesting experiment I want to show, which is what I will condense my talk, is about what they call molecular unzipping. Instead of stretching the DNA from the opposite ends, DNA is made of two phosphate chains, one coiled around the other, right? Forming a double helix. Instead of stretching from the opposite ends, I will pull the DNA molecule from the same end, but the two strands. So this experiment is totally different. Instead of stretching a cord, what I do is I unravel the cord. I separate the two strands of the same cord. Okay? So for that, of course, I need to break the base pairs that stabilize the double helix. So I had before an elastic experiment, an elastic response. Now with this experiment, I will have a fracture response. Okay? So this is the movie, but this is the experiment. Instead of pulling the DNA from the two ends, opposite ends, I pull from the same end, and therefore I unwind the double helix. And what happens is that by doing this, I convert the double-stranded DNA into single-stranded DNA. So this is clearly a phase transformation. I go from one phase to another phase. Okay? And to repeat this experiment many times, I need, you know, if you stretch the DNA, there is no problem. You can cyclically repeat the same stretching. But if you unzip it, this is what we call, if you separate the two strands, you need to close them at the end. Otherwise, you end up with two strands totally separated. So if I want to repeat back and forth this experiment of conversion to single-stranded, reannealing of the two strands, and zipping the two strands, reannealing the two strands, and so on, I need to close with a loop the end of the DNA molecule. This is what I do. And therefore, you will see now that what I measure is totally different. This is the force as a function of the position of the trap, okay? And the force goes from zero, it goes up, and at some point, when I reach around 14 piconewtons, I start to unravel the double helix, and I see this fracture signal, this sawtooth pattern, that will go from 0 nanometers up to 6,000 approximately, which is the total extension that I will obtain in this conversion from double-stranded to single-stranded. So this curve goes, this measurement goes on. Stop, and then you see. Now at the end, you will see that I convert this, I'm converting now this to single-stranded DNA, and at some point when I have finished the 6,800 base pairs corresponding to 6,600 nanometers, I will get single-stranded DNA. So I will see a purely elastic response of single-stranded DNA. You will see this is purely elastic response now. This is elastic. And when I relax the force, that's blue now relaxing, something remarkable happens. And that's the most interesting thing in this experiment. I would say that's the key signature that is useful for us physicists to measure fluctuations. That you see, I completely reproduce the unfolding, the unzipping pattern. So there is no hysteresis. Okay? This is pulled at 25 nanometers per second. Of course, here it is accelerated. This whole experiment takes like 5 minutes, like a few minutes. But there is no hysteresis. So the molecule, once has been unzipped, the two strands of single-stranded that are complementary in boot form a double helix, upon relaxing the force, start to nucleate in the middle of the chain and starts to reform the double helix again. And this is remarkable because I always say the same example. It's like if you take a piece of material like this, for example, a piece of chalk, and you this is a material, and you fracture it. Now you say, no, I will reform it again. Well, you can go ahead and try it, but it will never reform. I'm doing the same, okay, but it reforms. And this is the key feature, and I go now to you. This is a key feature of this, of molecular matter, with matter from living beings with respect to matter, ordinary matter. Ordinary matter is stably organized or stably, is kept by strong molecular bonds, like covalent interactions. But biological matter has to remodel continuously because in your body, cells are dying and new cells are formed every time, continuously, all the time. So for the body to be rebuilt continuously and remodeled continuously in time, interactions have to be weak. So interactions have to be weak in order to be comparable to the thermal noise. And therefore, any fracture process be reversible. So in biology, we don't talk about fracturing materials, but remodeling materials. And this you see clearly in this experiment. Yeah.
So the red parts are where the two curves are not superimposable. So this is no hysteresis, where we see some parts which are red?
So yeah, that's correct. There are two contributions that make these differences. And sometimes it's experimental drift in the measurement, because this is actually much lower than I show you here. It takes a few minutes, and you may have some drift. But actually, in this case, this is hysteresis probably, because when I said it's completely reversible, this completely you must to be quoted. I mean, of course, this was at 25 nanometers per second. If I go to 5 nanometers per second, then I wouldn't see these things. So always you do the experiment at fine speed, and something remains, okay? But it's not a big hysteresis, it's controllable. I could reduce further probably if I wanted to, okay? So please, I didn't say, but interrupt me at any time. If you have any question, I will be most glad to answer, okay? In these measurements, you may ask whether they are relevant, interesting or not. And just to make this story short, when we published, or when we did these experiments were originally done actually here in Paris in École Normale Supérieure by Bockelmann and Heslop. This was done in 1997, if I'm not wrong, at the end of the 90s. And these experiments were remarkable because they were shown that you had control even on the fracture process of the double helix. But they have a beautiful turn. There is a beautiful story behind these experiments. And this is the fact that we can use these measurements to extract the binding free energies of complementary base pairing in DNA. So you know, DNA is continuously manipulated in the labs. It intervenes in many molecular reactions in the lab. And many of these reactions constitute, or many of these reactions are melting of DNA. You just take your DNA molecule, and for example, if you want to do polymerase chain reaction, PCR amplification of DNA, you have to melt DNA and re-anneal it, melt DNA. And I mean, it's a process in which you duplicate the amount of your DNA, but in this process of duplicating, you have to somehow melt the DNA to separate the two strands to restart the duplication process. So this process of duplication of DNA, this melting process, you do it in the PCR reaction by increasing the temperature of the water. Here we are not changing temperature. This is everything at room temperature, 25 Celsius. But what we do is we apply mechanical force. So the question is that even if you know thermodynamics, if you want to measure the free energy difference between two states, you don't worry about which path you follow, because the free energy is a state function. So all pathways that lead to the same final product give you the same measurement of the free energy difference. Okay? So instead of what this tells you is that if I want to measure the free energy of binding of two complementary DNA strands, I don't need necessarily do this with melting. I can do that with force. And with force, what I need to take into account is that when I stretch, there is not only the contribution of breaking the complementary Watson-Crick base bonds, base pair bonds, but also there is the contribution of this stretching of the single-stranded DNA. So because I'm at a force, every time I free a segment of single-stranded DNA, I have to stretch it up to the working force. And this elastic contribution has to be taken into account. So what we did was, and that's something we have done very recently, a few years ago for a specific case, but now more general, we developed a methodology to extract the base pairing free energy in arbitrary, let's say, salt conditions. And that's nice because it's a way to extract this free energy of the different base pair combinations, okay, by using force methods. Okay? Now, this is very important because the resolution that we can get with these force measurements is somehow better than what you can get with usual bulk methods, what we call bulk methods, when you use a bulk sample with many molecules, for example, by colorimetry or even by UV absorbance or fluorescence. In this case, you get average numbers of many molecules. The nice thing of these experiments that you do on one molecule, you have a possible sequence along your DNA molecule, possible motifs that you can represent, and you can extract them by analyzing a few amount of data, let's say. Okay? And on the other hand, because we have very much resolution on force and distances, we can get a very good resolution on free energy differences. And actually, the free energy resolution or accuracy that you can get with these sort of measurements goes down to 0.1 kcal per mole. 0.1 kcal per mole is around 0.1 kbts. Okay, so actually, it's more 0.2 kbts than 0.1 kbts. But this tells you what is the precision of this technique to measure energies. We can measure a tenth of kbt. And if you remember that one molecule in water carries in average 3/2 kbt, which is 1.5 kbt, I mean, it's 1/10 of the average kinetic energy of one single water molecule. And there are many water molecules around, of course. So that's nice and remarkable. Now, these numbers have been introduced, for example, in servers that tell you, for example, what is melting temperature or specific DNA sequences by changing temperature, for example. And these servers are usually made by chemists, okay, who use phenomenological models to predict temperature, melting temperatures of arbitrary DNA sequences. And there is one of them I show you here. Well, this is one which is called UMELT that actually is made actually to predict the best PCR, for example, protocols, cooling, heating protocols in DNA to amplify it. So what they do is the servers give you melting curves of arbitrary DNA sequences. And if you go, for example, for this case, you write here a given sequence, okay, that would be a DNA sequence made of, I don't know, for example, 20 base pairs. So these are the 20 nucleotides on one strand. The other strand is fully complementary. It's not written, of course. Now you can select to know the melting curve. You would measure, for example, in circular dichroism. You can select which numbers you want to use. And our paper was, so you see most of the numbers that were used as thermodynamic numbers to predict these curves were made in the 80s and the 90s. And the last numbers that were put in the server. The first one is 1986 by Ken Breslauer, who is in Rutgers University. He's a chemist there. And then the last one was by the group of John Santa Lucia, which is his MELSIM 1999. Okay. Now, after that, it's 10 years of lapse. And in 2010, they introduced our work that we published in 2010. So these numbers that we get, these force measurements, are used by chemists, okay, to predict that. So this, and that was for long DNA. And it's an application of these accurate measurements of free energy. There is another thing that you can do it that more in general. You can not only unzip DNA, but you can only also unzip RNA, okay, or unzip proteins. Because anytime you, whenever you have a polymer that you can label at the ends, you can bind these to micron-sized beads, and therefore you can stretch the molecule. And if this molecule is stabilized by intramolecular interactions, like in the case of a protein, then you can break these molecular interactions by doing the same game as I did for the double helix. So any biological polymer can be actually studied with this technique. So this, for example, is the case for an RNA. For an RNA, when you pull the molecule, you see a force rip at a given force, which always is around the same range as for DNA, a little bit larger. So this is 16, 17 piconewtons. You see this rip, which corresponds to the release of the base pairs that are encoded in this RNA herpin. This is a 20 base pair herpin, and the force jump is about 1 piconewton, which corresponds to the release of these 20 base pairs. And after you go up, and when you relax the force, that's the green, it folds back again. So maybe I can just show you an animation of this sort of rupture process you would have for the case of a DNA hairpin. So this is force as a function of extension. And what you see is that the force goes up, and then at some point there is this jump. This is the release of the base pairs, okay, captured in the molecule. And when you relax the force, it goes up. And of course, here you see that the unfolding force is higher than the folding force. This is 16, 17, this is 15. There is a difference. Always systematically, you tend to break things at a higher force than you reform them. Okay? But of course, it may happen that sometimes you break the molecule at a force that is below the force of any of the cycles. So it may happen that it folds back, not at a low force, but at a high force. This is something that we see sometimes. Okay? So this you could go on. And every time you would do this, you would find that the force is different, because this is a stochastic process. It's driven by thermal fluctuations. It's driven by noise. Okay? Another thing that we can do, which is even more interesting, we published the results very recently this January in Biophysical Journal. We can pull on proteins and Z proteins by doing the same game. Proteins are much more interesting, because proteins do not form, let's say, a one-dimensional structure like the herpins. The herpins are one-dimensional. Okay, they don't have even a secondary structure. They are very simple DNA molecules, because they are fully complementary. RNAs may be different, but DNA not. But proteins, there are no rules for knowing how it folds. So it's very difficult to predict how a protein folds unless you use like sophisticated models or phenomenological models that tell you what is the minimum free energy structure. The nice with these experiments, the nice thing is that we can see that experimentally. So here is, for example, a protein called Barnes, which is an enzyme. It has activity of RNAs, which means degrades RNA. It has 110 amino acids. Okay? And then what we do is we do the same experiments before. We stretch, we move the optical trap relative to the bead, and then we measure the force extension curve, or the force trap position curve, let's say. And that's what we see. We see that the force breaks at some force, and then it goes up. And then you see here this plateau, which corresponds to the stretching of the molecular handles. And when you fall back, you relax the force, the molecule forms back again. Okay? So now let me just try to show you how this connects with this, with the main title of the talk about energy information and fluctuations. I mean, how we can use these model systems to answer questions about non-equilibrium non-equilibrium physics. Okay? And I will start just by putting a perspective. So you see, these experiments are very interesting. And that's, to us, were always very interesting because it's a way to accurately measuring energies. And when I said that these numbers are used by servers to predict melting temperatures, this is a proof that we are capable of measuring energies very, very well. Now, what turns out to be less immediate, and now we are realizing over the past years, is that these techniques are very useful also to measure information. So single molecule techniques are not only good for measuring energies, they are also good for measuring information. And here you see information is energy, everyone knows what is information, energy, everyone more or less knows what is energy. But for information, things start to be more tricky. And that's what I think is more interesting of these techniques. We have now experimental tool to measure information and answer questions about how information sneaks into biology. Okay? And I want to show this triangle. You will see now a triangle. Put always triangle sometimes, but triangle in which I try to tell you why I think information is interesting and might be key for understanding many things, especially for the coming years. If you take the three fundamental, I would say the two most fundamental theories that we may think of now concerning condensed matter, we would say that, okay, you know, it's a very important relation between energy and time, okay, which is the uncertainty principle. Okay, so we know that whenever we want to measure the position of a particle very, very well, then we will miss what happens with the velocity, and of course there will be a big uncertainty on the velocity and the other way around. That's the uncertainty principle. On the other hand, we know that information and energy are connected. And of course, we don't know what is exactly information, but at least we have a quantity, a measurement of information, or a relation of information with something we know in physics, which is entropy. So Shannon entropy is something that we know corresponds to a statistical, to the Gibbs statistical entropy. Okay? In equilibrium systems, Gibbs entropy is Shannon entropy. Okay? So they coincide in equilibrium. And if you want to write a relation between the two, between the energy and the information thought of as Shannon entropy, and Gibbs statistical entropy, you would get that relation. And this information counted, for example, in bits of information. Okay? Now you can combine these two relations and get a relation between information and time. And if you put numbers, you get this relation just. You could put numbers, this tells you that information and time, they have some sort of uncertainty relation, which for room temperature, it depends on temperature, okay, is 10 to the minus 13 bits per second. Okay? So of course, energy and information are very different, or energy and entropy are very different, because energy is conserved and information is not conserved. Entropy is not conserved. Entropy always grows. So what means a fluctuation, what means an uncertainty relation for an entropy or for an information, a quantity that systematically grows? And here I think we have with a new paradigm of thinking. That's a personal opinion, and of course I may be 100% wrong, but I think that information sneaks continuously into biology in a way that we do not understand. Okay? So there are fluctuations. Information is a quantity that one day we will have a better understanding. Now if you take any book of biochemistry, all arrows of chemical reactions are in K cal per mole. But one day, probably, we will see that many reactions in biochemistry books or in books on biophysics, in cellular biophysics, are not in K cal per mole, maybe are in bits of information. Because it's, of course, clear that biological systems are driven by more information than K cal per mole, necessarily. Okay? Of course, we need energy to be for living beings, they need to be fed up by energy, and metabolism is a proof that we need energy. But information is crucial. Okay? And what we can do in single molecule, we can measure energy to 0.1 kBT accuracy. That's what I was telling you before, this energy measurement. This complementary base pair is 0.1 kcal per mole. We can do that with that accuracy, and therefore we can go and use these accurate measurements to hear what I call here the audible hiss around the second law of thermodynamics. Sometimes reactions, in average reactions, tend to produce a positive entropy, let's say, or entropy production is positive. But sometimes we see that sometimes for a given set of for some trajectories we see events where the entropy production is negative. Okay, so this is what I understand by his. And I think that Bernard explained you about the Crookes fluctuation relation already and the Yerzynski equality. You introduced it already. So it's basically I show you here a slide to show you what we can use these audible his fluctuations for something useful in these experiments. In particular, we can use them to recover free energy differences. And this is the core of the Yerzynski equality. This is, if you want, one nice application of being accurate enough to measure energy fluctuations and use that information that you measure from energy fluctuations to get free energy differences from irreversible, intrinsically irreversible processes. So the great contribution of Yerzynski is that if you take any textbook of thermodynamics, if you want to measure free energy difference, you need to do a quasi-static process. There is no way to get free energy differences from irreversible processes. But we know that is not true anymore. We can get free energy differences from irreversible processes. Now, the Crookes fluctuation relation is schematically illustrated in this slide. You start from equilibrium at initial time with a system with initial value of the control parameter. You change the control parameter according to a predetermined manner, and you do it fast enough for driving the system out of equilibrium at time tf. When the control parameter is lambda f, my system is not in equilibrium anymore. Now I let it relax to equilibrium, and I start again from equilibrium after letting it relax, this value of the control parameter, following the protocol, the time reverse protocol. It's a mirror image according to this vertical axis of this function here. So you repeat this experiment many times. Lambda as a function of t doesn't fluctuate. It's always the same. But the trajectory followed by the system, this q of t that Bernard was showing, is following different trajectories in time. And for each of these trajectories, you measure the work you do upon the system in doing this perturbation from lambda I to lambda f according to the protocol. And you measure the work distribution in the release process, in the reverse process, sorry, among many or across many, many, many trajectories, ideally infinite number of trajectories, you measure the work distribution along the reverse process. Now, because the work, it has a sign, is change sign, the work, okay, like the heat, are quantities that change sign with respect time reversal, then you need to compare, to make a statement about the reversibility of the system, I have to make a statement and compare the work distribution along the forward process with the negative work distribution along the reverse. But that's just because the work change sign in this mirror image operation, okay? This time reversal symmetry. So this gives you the exponential of the dissipated work by kbt or the exponential work minus delta g over kbt. So this relation was put forward by Gavin Crookes, I think it was in 1998, he published a paper as a continuation or as a generalization of the Yerzynski equality, because actually from this relation you know you can extract the Yerzynski equality. You just move the exponential to the left, the probability distribution of the reverse process to the right, you integrate over the work, you get one on one side, and the expectation value of the exponential of minus the work on the other side. Now, when this was proposed, at that time, it was 98, but it was there in Berkeley in the beginning of the 2000, and that time, Carlos Bustamante had done the experiment with the Yerzynski equality. It was the first experiment pulling a molecule. But then we realized very easily, it was very straightforward realizing that the Crookes relation was more powerful than the Yerzynski. Because in one pulling experiment, you have to do, for the Yerzynski equality, you have to average over many trajectories. So this means that you have to stretch many times the molecule, hundreds, thousands if possible. But then, of course, every time you have to stretch, then if you want to repeat a stretching process, you have to relax. So we said, OK, for the same price, we measure the stretching and the releasing. So in the same experiment, you get both terms here. And then what we tested is that actually this relation, this radio here, follows the exponential relation. When do I have to finish?
15 minutes, 20 minutes.
OK. 15 OK. So if you take this relation, you see, the nice prediction of this relation is whatever distributions you measure, they should cross, independently of how far from equilibrium is your pulling protocol, they should cross at delta g. Because at w equal delta g, the exponential of 0 is equal to 1, so they cross each other. So that was a nice thing of this Crookes relation. Just measure the distribution, world distributions, and if they cross each other, look where they cross at delta g. And if they don't cross each other, you are then you are in trouble, but then you can do something else, more elaborated. But conceptually, it's the same. If you get always enough statistics to make them cross, you are done. And now you do these experiments with the DNA hairpin, for example. Here, 20 base pairs. Okay, you stretch this hairpin many times, and you see the same curves I showed you before. Before, it was for RNA, but it's the same. Yeah? It's the same sort of cooperative transition. The base pairs are broken. The molecule is converted into single-stranded. And if you measure for one curve, the word distribution means that you fix the initial trap position at one value. You fix the final trap position at another value. That would be lambda I and lambda f. You fix these two values, and you measure areas below curves. So it's just integrating experimental data. Now, of course, the things are easy to say, but experimentally it's more difficult because you have drift, your curves start to disalign, some molecules, sometimes the instrument doesn't transmit data accurately enough. There are always sort of minor problems that you can cope with them. And at the end, you get to these results that I show you here in three colors. Each color corresponds to a loading rate, or pulling speed, if you want. 1 piconewton per second, 5 piconewtons per second, and 15 piconewtons per second. Now, the 1 piconewton per second is shown in blue. The continuous line is a forward, is a stretching process, okay? The forward process, when you unfold the hairpin. And the dashed line is the reverse process, when you release the force, when you fold back the hairpin, okay? And be aware that in some of these curves, there might be hopping transitions. So always, it may occur that the molecule unfolds, but then it has enough time to fold back and so on. You have to count properly. The area is the area. Just a simple thing, okay? Now, you will see that these two distributions blue cross each other around here. Now, if you increase the speed, that's the green, which is 5 piconewtons per second. And for the green, at 5 piconewtons per second, you see it's larger, the loading rate. The speed is larger. So you generate more hysteresis. So this is like your question before. So if I had to pull faster, I would have seen more hysteresis. If I pull slower, hysteresis decreases. So the area coming back is systematically lower than the area going after. Stretching and folding area is larger than folding areas. But the crossing is more or less keeps on the same range of black dashed lines. And if you increase the pulling speed still, so we get a good estimate, you see, with an error of around 1 kBT, because this is 80 kBT is 82. And so on. So this is an error. We have experimental error to determine this crossing point. Now, if you take, because here we have a nice superposition of the word distributions, forward and reverse along a given word range, we can take the ratio at any word value of the continuous line and the dashed line. We have experimental data. We can take the ratios. And if we take the ratios, we see something like this. This is the prediction by the fluctuation relation. And if you take the logarithm, it should be linear on the work. And the slope should be equal to 1 in kBT units. And in our experimental error is 0.96. There's always some calibrations errors that contribute to have this number slightly different from 1. Okay? But this is mixing different molecules and different speeds. So here you have different molecules and all speed from 1 piconewton per second to 15 piconewton per second. You can do that. So this was done, as I said, this was done originally in 2005 for some RNA molecules. Then what I showed you before were my experiments in my lab afterwards in 2009. And later, we extended this fluctuation relation to what I call a relation for partially equilibrated states. So the Crookes fluctuation relation, you don't need to be initially in full equilibrium. You can be in partial equilibrium. So you can be in equilibrium in some metastable states. Now, if you are in equilibrium in a metastable state, you are in a Boltzmann-Gibbs restricted state somehow. Okay? Of course, you are not in full equilibrium because a metastable state can have higher free energy than equilibrium free energy. But you can partially equilibrate on that state, and all properties look as if the system was in equilibrium. This is what in biochemistry or molecular biology sometimes is called kinetic states. And kinetic states are many examples, intermediate states in folding pathways, for example, misfolded states, bound states of ligands to, for example, molecules, and so on. Okay? And this we did in 2012. Here we published the relation, and then we did the experimental test, let's say, in kinetic states in different DNA molecular folders. And now just to finish my presentation, it's about information. And information is an interesting thing because we know that now information plays the game also in fluctuation relations, starting from the initial words by Sagawa and Ueda, and then this has been continued. And it's a sort of very nice playground for these ideas. And I insist, I mean, in the same way that I had, I told you that room temperature, we have uncertainties in our measurement of 0.1 kBTs. This translates immediately that we have uncertainties of 0.1 bits automatically. So for the same reason we have 0.1 kBT accuracy, we have 0.1 bit accuracy. And it's a very good accuracy, okay? Which of course in terms of entropies would mean 0.1 kB, Boltzmann constant. And now there is a very nice experiment where you can test the concept of information, which is the Maxwell demon. And I think you will hear more about this probably next week by Sergio Ciliberto, but I just mentioned you the classical interpretation and explanation of this sort of paradox. So what happens here is that we have a gas, we have a big vessel, let's say, okay, that is made separated by a small door in two halves. So there are two halves of this vessel. When the door is open, the molecules can travel from right to left and left and right, okay, with even probability. But now we put here a small intelligent being, okay, that's a small intelligent being endowed of capabilities of measurement. And what he does is demon, this small being, is to look at molecules. And whenever he sees a molecule that he is fast, if he sees a fast molecule moving from the left to right, the demon allows it to pass. But if the fast molecule goes from right to left, then it blocks the door, doesn't allow it to pass. And for the same thing, that's for the slowest molecules, for the blue ones. For the slowest blue molecules, if it sees that it goes from left to right, it blocks. If it goes from right to left, it allows to go through. Okay? So at some point, it will happen that the system will have conserved energy, but at the end I will have a difference in temperature in the two halves of the vessels because here we'll have the slow molecules and here we'll have the fast molecules. So I will generate, and that's the key point of the Maxwell demon, this process of observation, okay, and opening and closing the gate is done at zero cost. So there is no work performed on that. So at the end of the game, you produced a temperature gradient, which means a decrease of the total entropy of the universe at zero cost. And that's the Maxwell demon paradox, okay? So where it comes the resolution of this paradox, I said that you need zero effort to do that. And well, actually one may think that it's not correct because if you make an observation, you need to spend something. If you open the gate, you need to spend something. At the end of the day, it turns out that actually there is no cost in these operations. Observation, and there is no cost in opening the gate. The cost comes in erasing the bit that is written after one observation. So this daemon has to store this information somewhere, and to come to the initial state has to erase it. It's in the erasure process that you save the second law. Okay, that's the short one century story. Now you can do another representation of the Maxwell demon, which is the Szilard motor. The Maxwell demon is microcanonical, let's say, constant energy. Szilard motor is canonical. You keep the constant temperature. Then what you can do is you can have a vessel molecule inside the gas in constant with a heat bath at constant temperature. And every time you see a molecule on one side, for example, here on the left, you put the wall. And then you allow the molecule to collide with the wall and expand. And in this way, expand, put a weight, a lever, and use the expansion of this one molecule gas to convert this into useful work. Okay? And once you convert into work, you take the wall and you make the same. You start to again observing the molecule, which is the left, you put again the same thing on the same. You put against the wall and you start the work and so on. Now this process, you can demonstrate that the maximum average X-ray work that you can do in this process, assuming there are no losses in the observation, assuming there are no losses in putting this wall, it's kBT, or is the temperature multiplied by the entropy change in the observation. So you change the entropy by kB log 2, and if you multiply by this temperature, that's the average maximum work, or the maximum average work you can extract per cycle in the Zeller's model. Okay? If you have more bits, then of course you can do more, but that's for the two-bit, what is called the two-bit Zeller's motor. And actually we have a nice experimental realization of the two-bit Zeller's motor, which is our two-bit state of the molecule. The molecule, I told you that when we stretch it, it can be mechanically unfolded if you reach high enough forces. And if you relax forces, it falls back. So we can do what we call hopping experiments, okay? In which what you do, for example, you keep the position of the optical trap constant, and you stretch the construct up to a force which is around 15 piconewtons. And then if this force corresponds to the region where you see, where you saw the unfolding, mechanical unfolding, so if you stretch the optical trap at around a position where the force is around 16 piconewtons, this thing that you see by dynamically pulling the trap, you will see also with the trap stationary. You will see that the molecule unfolds and refolds following what is called an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. It's a dichotomic noise, and you can measure lifetimes and so on. So we have here like a molecule that can be in two states. So this is equivalent in the Zeller's motor, observing one particle in a vessel, in a big vessel, and then deciding which half of the two vessels the gas particle is exactly the same. We observe the force trace of the molecule, and depending if it is in this level of force on this, we decide on which side we are. So we can implement this, okay? So of course, just an important thing to know is that depending on this force, you can populate more the one state or the other. So for example, if you go to high forces, you tend to populate more than folded state with respect to the folded. If you go to low forces with respect to the coexistent force where you have equal lifetimes, you populate more the folded with respect to the unfolded. So we can tune the lifetimes of the two states with this position of the optical trap and the average force. So what we do is a DNA-based Maxwell daemon. These are measurements done by Marco Rivetti-Crivellari. He's here in the audience. Or what he does is he tracks the force, okay, with a constant position. And then if he sees that the molecule, in this case, is folded, then what he does, so you see the force, the high force means that the molecule has been folded. Okay? So if the molecule is folded, he immediately relaxes the force, okay, to a lower value and gradually increases it and records the extracted work from the molecular folding, from the molecular, in this case, unfolding, as the initial value of the force is recovered. If, on the other hand, in this observation time, the molecule is seen to be unfolded, okay, then he would see, what he would do is to increase the force, to stretch the optical trap, and then relax the force again to extract work from this protocol. So this is a variation of the Zeller motor, if you want. That's doing this process of pushing the optical trap back again is like recovering the initial state. This is like the leverage process you do in the Zeller's motor schematic representation. Now you can do that. There are several issues to take into account in these measurements, but I don't want to go into these details. These are right now at this moment unpublished results, but the idea is that when you do these experiments, of course, moving the optical trap very fast to do this cycle and to complete the cycle and extracting the work, the leverage process, so you introduce some error in the measurement, and also you introduce some friction because you are dragging the bit away with the speed, and this introduces some friction. So there are issues that are important, or there are corrections, okay? But the nice thing of these measurements, even if there are corrections to the measurement process, we would like to have a very neat process. Actually, the nice thing of these experiments is that we can actually may put into the theory of the Zeller's motor the contribution of these dissipation losses. Now, if you forget about the losses, and that would be my last slide, if you forget about the losses, you can tell, measure about, upon repeating these experiments for many hopping conditions, from coexistence, which is this green, up to the case in which, for example, you are mostly in the unfolded state, so these are high forces, mostly in the unfolded state, low forces, mostly in the folded state, and intermediate situations, okay? Slightly more in the unfolded here, slightly more in the folded here. Green is the coexistence. You can measure for each color, for each condition, the extracted work distribution, okay? And you can see that in average, the extracted work distribution here, extracted work from the Zeller's motor means that the work is negative. So here, I show you word distribution. There is a long tail with positive words. I mean, we really lose a lot, okay? But in some cases, you can extract. And this dashed line is a Landauer limit, which is KBT log 2. So in KBT units, it's log 2, 0.69. And you see that sometimes the average is always lower. That what I can extract in this case is lower than 0.69. It would be something around, I don't know, 0.45. But I reach the optimal one at coexistence. That's where you can reach the maximum Landauer limit. So that's the nice thing. We can demonstrate experimentally this. But we also see the fluctuations. And by the way, I should say, this experiment has been done with single electron boxes by the group of Jukka Pekola in Aalto University in Finland, in Helsinki. But he did the experiment at 50 millikelvins. This is at 300 Kelvin. But it's still the same thing applies. Okay? You can introduce losses in the analysis and so on. But I think here is a good time to stop because it's already 1 hour. And you must be very, very, very tired from Bernard's talk and mine too. So I will just end up by thanking the people in the group. And people are doing several projects at this moment. I'm moving a lot to use single molecule for this information stuff. And this has been initiated by Marco, but also for molecular evolution to try to quantify information in molecular evolution. People are working here mostly now in RNA molecules. Some people are still on DNA, but I'm moving to RNA and proteins. But I must underline the great work by Marco Rivezzi, who he moved in January to SPCI biology. And he's doing microfluidics of evolutionary models for helicases. And he has done outstanding work. And you have the great opportunity of having him here in Paris. Talk to him. He knows a lot about this. I will just leave with you with a summary. And thank you very much for your attention.